Typically. Okay. Good morning. My name is Chantel Rodriguez. I am here in Lansing, Michigan. I am interviewing today Jennifer Wylon Strodel. She is in Hudson, New York, and we're talking today as part of the Education Narratives Project. And so I'm thinking of someone who hasn't heard your first couple interviews. So can you tell us about yourself for those folks?
Sure. I am an educator and a writer and a mother. And in 2015, I started a independent school called the Libri School in Hudson, New York. And the mission is really to liberate children and teachers to think freely, to be themselves, to embrace creativity, and to imagine their lives in the context of humanity. So it was a very mission-driven project, and that continues to be my personal mission and the mission of the Libri School. In 2015, we started it as an independent school. And, you know, we were really looking to create a new model of education that was more contemporary, that really addressed the needs of children today, and what, you know, and with the big looming question of how do we prepare our children for a future that as the adult generation, we can't even begin to imagine changes are happening so quickly. So what can we do for children instead of sitting down and making them memorize facts and, you know, various algorithms that are already kind of obsolete in terms of the skills that they're going to be needing as they grow older? You know, how can we educate children so that we truly are preparing them in a holistic way for an unknown future? And so for me, my mission was kind of to try and figure out the most streamlined way to do that. And in 2015, it was to start this private school in the community that I lived with my own children and the parents who were also kind of thinking along the same lines, and with the teachers who are thinking along the same lines. So we created the Libri School, which was an amazing project and a truly an incredible community and educational experience for everyone. You know, it's very arts integrated, rigorous academics, and really also very social, a lot of social emotional learning, so that the children were in multi-age groups and were really asked to almost function like a family, you know, very close relationships and treating each other and working together in that sense. And that was wonderful. But when the pandemic hit, you know, it really, there was a lot of things happened that were unexpected and kind of pushed a lot of other issues to the forefront in my mind. And we did close down the physical location completely and jumped all into virtual courses. And So this past year, I've been running Libri School as a virtual only program. And it's because of the way the New York State education laws are currently, it means families who are taking programs with us are filing as homeschoolers. So it's no longer considered sort of a private school, just because we don't have, now we could be doing that if we maintained a physical location, even if it was sitting empty. It's one of those kind of technical things in the education law. But we didn't, you know, we gave up our lease on the building. So we are 100% virtual. And so that's been this past school year. And then we're kind of coming to the end of this past school year. And again, Libri School finds itself at another turning point. So it's exciting to be able to talk to you today, because here we are at yet another crossroads, as we all are.
Yes, yeah. Indeed. So it's been a little over a year. So since everything has changed. So tell me about this crossroads now.
So the virtual programming we created this year was, again, amazing and successful in the sense that we were able to achieve a lot of the goals I had hoped to set out to achieve, which was really live cohort-based learning, so that there was really a community feel, and that even though it was virtual through Zoom, and a lot of the teachers and students haven't even been able to meet each other in person yet, they really were able to build a sense of belonging and community and intimacy and really get to know each other very well. Just the way, you know, we expected, we had it going in the in-person library classroom, where it's really about relationship building. And that's, you know, that's also a core belief of mine as an educator, is all teaching and learning happens in relationship. So relationship comes first, and then you get all the good stuff of expanding minds. But without trust and, you know, intimacy and personal connection and engagement on that personal level, it's very difficult to reach learners. So that was really successful. And, you know, there's great little stories like in, you know, the early childhood teacher who teaches kindergarten, first grade. Within a few weeks of holding her virtual class, and the teacher's located in Connecticut. So she hasn't met any of the students in person. But within, you know, the first couple weeks of class, when they log off, like it kind of surprised her, but, you know, it also felt really natural, you know, as they were logging off one day after school, one of the little boys, the kindergarten boys, just was like, "Bye, I love you." You know, just like he would in the classroom with a normal kindergarten teacher. And it's just that, you know, I think that early on we recognize that we can, you know, we're all humans. And even though we can't actually physically touch each other, our spirit and our personalities do come through. And if we care for each other, that is coming through the screen. So that has been successful. And there's also another thing that's emerged, which is really interesting, which is that in virtual learning, children get to learn at home. Mm-hmm. So there's a certain kind of safety, I think, mm-hmm. and relaxed state of being that they get to experience by not by just being in their own homes. And then there's also a certain lack of distraction, mm-hmm. because they're really, you know, focused on the task at hand as they're engaging in these virtual classes. And they're not, you know, it's not layered on with all the social drives and the urges, you know, when you have a group of children in a room together. So that in terms of academics and engaging the children intellectually, that was sort of a silver lining, and something that was interesting to watch, is the level of focus that you could get achieve in this format was exciting. And so that was a bonus. Now, the turning point is that after a year of virtual learning, I realized too that the in-person component, I guess I had expected parents to be able to sort of organize and arrange in-person experiences for their children, you know, more independent outside of school. But it really is, and even for myself and in our life, and it's really difficult to kind of orchestrate that, mm-hmm. in a way that schools are able to, for children to just sort of get them into social groups in person. Mm-hmm. And I really do believe, so now we're at another turning point, because I'm trying to figure out how to move forward where we can continue to, you know, I guess I'm just trying to say, like, the virtual, the 100% virtual schooling, I guess for me, while there's a pandemic, it makes a lot of sense. As we hopefully emerge out of the pandemic, and we really can't predict how long that's going to be, but as we do emerge out of the pandemic, I'm really understanding there's such a need for children just to gather and be in person together, and that I'm kind of thinking now, like, the virtual programming has a place, mm-hmm. in children's lives and in families' lives, but it might not be the whole, you know, unless you're a child who has a special reason to take virtual schooling because your family's traveling a lot, or you're traveling a lot for, you know, for your, maybe you're pursuing a ski career or an acting career or something, mm-hmm. like that, or maybe you're immunocompromised. And so there is definitely a market and a group of children that this would really continue to be the best way forward. But then there, you know, there's, I'm also not sure that it's for everyone. Yeah. So that's the turning point we're at. So I'm kind of like now thinking about what would be the most valuable programs to continue offering virtually and to continue to reach a lot of children? And then what are new and exciting and creative ways to deliver the quote unquote school education in this sort of post, you know, after we've gone through this year of great change and rethinking and new priorities and new urgencies. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so interesting because I have a 10-year-old son, and I was so taken with the willingness for the public education here in Michigan and also the private schools to push to go back so quickly and push, and it just didn't make sense to me, given, that it just seemed like mitigating the health risks and mitigating all that was so time consuming that it just left this little teeny tiny part for the education, I in listening to your reasons for just saying, hey, let's just go virtual and remove all of that, I was really taken with that. And I was surprised that more school districts or school just didn't do that. And I guess it just comes down to, what is education to our communities, right? Yes. Is it childcare?
Yes, exactly.
This is what was really laid bare for me, that it did seem like, so I wonder if you can talk a little bit about that, the tensions with that, or, anyway, yeah, so.
Definitely, and I think that very much, that hit me on a very deep level when the pandemic first happened and we were all forced to close down our buildings.
Right.
As a school founder and director, I hadn't realized until that moment how much schools and the teachers and the people who work in schools really take on so much responsibility of a child's upbringing and like you said, like the childcare, the education, the social emotional learning, so much is held by the school, and parents really do lean against the school and have expectations that the school is taking care of all of that. And that was laid bare for me, and it was interesting because in that moment I started rethinking how did it evolve to become that way, and whether that's really healthy. Is that the healthiest way for us as a society and community to move forward, and what the root cause of that is? And I would argue that it's not the healthiest way, and that the root cause ultimately is economic, and I have been thinking about this for years, is that how unfair it is that in this country and probably around the world, but very much in America, it's, you can't survive, barely. I mean, unless very few families can survive on a single income anymore. And so we're in the situation where both parents are working full time. And so the question is, it's about childcare. It's about if all adults are working full time now, then who takes care of the children? And then we've relied on schools as institutions to take care of the children. And yet schools, I think progressive schools like the Libri School acknowledge that, and it was very community, centered and holistic. But in general, schools, I think, kind of are still of the mindset that they're responsible for the education of the child. and then these other things are extras and they're like added responsibilities, and they kind of, take care of them. Yeah. But it was, I think that it sort of is a school administrators and a teacher's first and foremost thinking is, we're supposed to educate these children. We're doing what the parents can't do, or it's like we're doing a specific we want to do a specific thing, which is teach the children how to read, teach the children how to write, think, do math, you know, engage in these more academic intellectual pursuits. And so, yeah, so that also became very clear to me. And that's why I'm excited. So therefore, for me as a school leader, I thought, well, with the virtual education, especially in the context of the pandemic, where I felt like my hands were tied, I couldn't actually keep your children safe. You know, there wasn't enough information out there. And like you pointed out, which I'm so grateful that you could see it, because it was something that was so clear to me, is that, you know, in normal times, we struggle with instruction time. You know, we want to fit so much more in than we can. And so much of that time in class is transitions and telling kids to stop talking to each other and, you know, all of that stuff. And so then when I saw the opportunity for virtual learning, I realized, wow, you know, we can get a lot done educationally in this context. And it's true. And, you know, our school days, in this past school year, we have 3 hours of virtual school a day, because also the other thing is I was very mindful of screen burnout and how being on Zoom is actually in a lot of ways more exhausting than being in person. So, and it's more focused, you know, you're kind of hyper-focused. So within 3 hours, we were able to achieve, you know, the academic goals that we wanted to, which in a school, you know, we're basically distilling out the education and there's not transitions and there's not, we're not adding in all those extra things. So, and then thought, well, then we can take care of the educational piece for the parents, kind of take that piece off of their plate. And then they can, you know, support their children in a physical sense and social emotionally. And of course, you know, the way we teach and learn, it is, like I said, all relationship-based. So within the context of the Zoom classes, we're working on social emotional learning all the time. But it's, you know, it's quite different than actually getting a group of kids together and playing and interacting.
Completely different, yes.
I also want to add that another part of my thinking with going 100% virtual was also the fact that, and this has played out to be true as I've spoken to families and children who did go back into in-person school, which is that not only would so much time and energy be focused on mitigating health risks when bringing children back into a classroom, not only time and energy, but the actual experience of children to be physically in a classroom all day, but not allowed to touch or interact, or, you know, always being in masks. I thought that in a lot of ways would create more anxiety for children and take them further away from that place of relaxation and trust and comfort, which we know you need to be. That's the mindset you need to be in to really absorb great learning and take risks intellectually and stretch yourself and all of that. So that was also for me very much informed my decision to go 100% virtual, was just thinking, you know, if you're bringing kids in that context, it's your, I didn't think we were setting them up for a year of rich learning. And so, yeah, and I think that, like I said, like my kids who have been 100% virtual have missed social interaction desperately. They have loved their learning experience, and they, you know, and they really understand that, and they understand the give and take of that, and they will talk about it, how it's been the most amazing year for them academically, but they're desperate to be around other kids again and to be in a class. You know, they want to be in a group. And then I speak to kids who've gone into in-person school, and everyone's had a different experience, but a lot of them do feel that it's just been kind of a bummer, you know, just like that it's not, they're still frustrated with the same, they still have the same desires. They say, I just want to be back in a classroom with more kids than just 6 kids or kids without masks, or, you know, or I just want to be able to interact.
Yes, it almost seems cruel in some way to just kind of put them in there, but not, you know, it's, yeah. But to embrace this idea of that, you know what, we're, this is how it's going to be, you know, and we're just going to have to stay home. I was really, really surprised that it was even, you know, an issue.
I was surprised too. And the other thing is, in Libri, we're always thinking about the teachers, you know, it's again, back to this idea of teaching and learning as a relationship, is like, you're not going to have really amazing learning happening if the teachers aren't engaged and happy and in their most creative, open place. And so I was like, how could you expect a teacher to possibly be in that place that they need to be to truly reach children if you're asking them to come back and they're expressing very vocally their fears and that they don't feel safe and they don't want to do this? And then the other thing is that I thought, you know, as an administrator, you can't, again, it's like setting people up to fail. That is the worst thing to do for teachers and students. And when I'm thinking about the teachers, I was thinking, how can I ask teachers to learn how to teach virtually well, as well as continue to do what they do in person, as well as mitigate all the health risks, you know, while they're going to, you know, it was pretty clear that we all individually, our families would be navigating our own personal health crisis. I mean, it's just, so, you know, you have to also calculate that's going to be an added stress on your teachers. And then, and then ask them to really be able to create a school year successfully. I thought that was way too much. And I think that has also played out, especially in public school systems that have gone hybrid or have done this sort of like week to week, you know, we'll tell you at the beginning of the week whether you're in or out, and also moving kids around so that the teachers don't really, it's hard to like keep track of who's coming in for in-person, who's in, you know, in virtual instruction. So I just thought, well, you know, if you ask teachers to do one thing really well, then they're creative and they'll do it and they'll figure it out. And they sure did. In at Libri, the teachers that taught just completely jumped in and were excited by the meet. It was a new creative moment for them.
Yeah.
So I think that the good thing is that at the end of this year, definitely the teachers and the students are recharged. You know, like I think a lot of people are burnt out, and I think that the teachers seem like they are actually inspired. You know, they haven't, because they haven't had to navigate that daily stress of all the other stuff. So that's
absolutely.
So that's been also really great. Yeah.
Yeah. So going forward, then you're now kind of poised at, okay, now what?
Yes, I'm poised at now what? And it's interesting because it's definitely, I'm very open. And I think that I'm really, you've caught me at a moment where I'm just, it's wide open. And I'm actually trying to identify and focus what is the greatest need, like where we can really sort of start focusing our energy and resources to really kind of do something that will be, very transformative for education. Mm-hmm. And I'm really wide open, and I'm sort of right now going through the process of really trying to figure that out on both sides, both from my philosophical standpoint, where I want to focus, and also from the needs of the community and what people are looking for. And so that's, I'm really wide open. I think that one thing that I did realize in terms of my own journey is that I am really excited about helping others start independent schools. I love the process, and I have so much to offer in terms of experience and expertise in terms of really starting an independent school that has a mission and a vision that's very specific. And I get excited and inspired to think about that, doing that process and helping people, like, you know, manifest that. I realized that for me personally, I'm actually not interested in reopening Libri as an independent private school, because because now I'm actually very deeply questioning the model of private schools and really wrestling with, you know, the issues of equity in education. And, you know, just for me running a private school, it doesn't feel for me the right way forward right now. Okay. I think that it's such an exciting moment in education, and that it's been so disrupted. The educational landscape in this country and around the world really has been so disrupted that it's a moment for really progressive change. And that calls for sort of radical thinking and really trying to think of innovative ways to deliver education and reach more children, that kind of leaves behind older models.
Yes.
And the model of the model of public school versus private school is really sort of an older model that I think that we can move on from. And I think that this, parents have realized, I mean, I've heard from a lot of parents that on the one hand, they need their kids their kids need to be in person. They want their kids to continue to be learning. In person, meaning they want their kids to be with other children.
Right. Part of a community somehow.
Yeah, socializing with other kids. Right. They want their kids to be continuing to learn. You know, they need their kids out of their home so that they can get their work done, right? For some parts of the day. But they hate the idea of going back to the routine of dropping their kids off every morning in the morning and then picking them up either right after school or after school care, and sort of not having their kids part of their life again anymore, which is what the model of school was before, was like parents go to work, kids go to school. We meet, you know, we're together at breakfast and then we're together at dinner and then it's bedtime and everyone's exhausted. School is exhausting. Work is exhausting. And then we have weekends together if we're lucky, and vacations if we're lucky. And I think this year has really given families this new perspective and realized and made them realize that no, you know, it's wonderful to be in a family where you can co-work, you know, like my kids in the virtual school, they log on to class and I don't see them for 3 hours, you know, they're engaged and they're doing their work. And so, you know, I don't have the answers, and that's where I am right now, is like, that's the drawing board, but I know the moment, and I know that the future of education doesn't look like what it looked like before. And I'm excited about the future of education. So that's why I'm sort of moving on from the idea of reopening. You know, parents ask me, are you going to reopen Libre School? I'm like, no, it's not going to look like what it looked like before.
Right.
You know? But I do believe that there's definitely a need, and that's why I'm excited about helping other people open up independent private schools, because I'd love to see lots of schools like Libre kind of flourishing and opening up. But I just, for me personally, I'm kind of more interested in kind of pushing forward and just sort of, you know, asking new questions and also reaching, the other thing is that there was a frustration with running a private school of only being able to reach a very small percentage of the population. So I think that was sort of, for me, a trap, because I thought that what we were doing was so incredible. And I always felt a little frustration that it's really hard to create a model that's inclusive and integrated into kind of the larger population of children who could really benefit from this kind of education too. So I'm trying to figure out how to deliver education in a way that's sort of broader and reaches a broader group of kids.
Yeah. Do you think, how do you envision, let's see, question, like how, you know, who are the people that you're speaking with about this, who could also really make change? Like, how do you actually do this? You know, where does it start?
In terms of trying to like explore new models of education or
right.
So the educators, the oral history education narratives cohort has mm-hmm. we've had some just really great conversations over the course of the year. So it's other educators mm-hmm. the same way. And it's everyone. The beautiful thing is that it's kind of having these conversations with educators where we can reinforce each other's thinking and our ideas resonate with each other, but then every educator, you know, applies it or manifests it differently. Mm-hmm. So the kind of people I'm talking to are fellow educators. Mm-hmm. And then parents are interesting because I talk to parents and they really don't know what they want, but I can ask them what's important to them. Mm-hmm. And sort of, I can hear feedback in terms of like what I was saying to you about, I'll talk to parents and I can listen to what their experience is and what's important to them, kind of like what's been difficult and challenging and what's been rewarding. And then from hearing their feedback, I can kind of think about how I might address, designing a model that might kind of answer some of those, mm-hmm. those issues for them. And then the other kind of group of people that I've been really listening to and talking with are sort of the entrepreneurial community, sort of like innovators, founders, and people who think like, you know, people who are, you know, whether it's tech startups or just local business owners, but people who have, who are engaging in that process of, I have something to offer in the world and I can do it in a different way. And I can do it in my way. And there's a process to this and I'm going to engage in the process. And so that's sort of, I'd say those are the three communities. And then of course the children themselves, just my children are my number one sounding board of just kind of like, you know, like right now, I think that it's interesting. My daughter, who's 12 and she's about to turn 13, she loves to learn. And so that's really important to her. But right now where she's at in life is that she's like, for next school year, when she thinks about next school year, her number one priority is just to be around other kids, mm-hmm. peers. And she's sort of like, she's so funny. She's like, you know, Mom, I'm good. You've given me a great education. Like, even if I'm not like, even if I don't go, if even if you enroll me in like a school that's not really that good, or she's just sort of like, I've got this. The education piece I've got, you know, like I'll figure it out. I'm a lifelong learner. I can take care of myself. You know, like I just need to be around other kids right now. And I totally get that. And then my son, who is 7 and he's turning 8. And ironically, before the pandemic, it was my daughter who was super, you know, engaged. School meant everything to her in terms of the actual learning, the academics, and socially. She, you know, it was difficult. She, of course, like all children, she wanted to be in social groups and everything, but she struggled. You know, she struggled to find the people that, you know, she had just she kind of struggled socially a bit. My son, who is 7 and turning 8. Was the opposite. He went to school for the fun. You know, he went to school for the kids. And he was the kind of kid that, you know, walked in a room and no matter who was in that room, he'd make a friend immediately. Mm-hmm. You know, easygoing, loves to laugh, very social creature. And so in the classroom, you know, his progress reports came back with more like, you know, we're working on focus and, you know, like, you know, like we're working on the appropriate times for silly jokes and not. And the teachers, you know, it was hard to get him really engaged and sunk in. I mean, he's clever and a quick learner and all that, but in terms of the school setting, right, was more socially driven and excited about the fun parts.
Yeah.
And then this year is the year that he really connected to his own learning process. And I think that in realizing just how fun it is to learn and how exciting his brain is, it was just, you know, once he clicks in and things are, you know, he's solving problems and he's so excited about all this, his learning, that he actually has been saying, like, I like virtual school better than in person. He misses, of course, he misses the social aspect, but in terms of when he thinks of the word school, he actually loves the idea of virtual school, and he's actually asking to stay in virtual school for next year. So it's just interesting that difference, you know, he's really keyed in to getting hooked on learning, which is what we're all about. Just that sort of that process that happens in kids, which is so exciting when their brain, when they can start feeling their brain learning, and then it's so motivating, and, you know, they can't get enough of it.
Yeah, that's exciting. Yeah. So in the virtual schooling for this year, then, how many students did you have for the virtual platform this year?
So the virtual platform, we struggled with enrollment, which is actually also why, like, moving forward, I'm like, I don't know, like, I don't do marketing. Mm-hmm. And that is tricky with virtual, because the Hudson Valley where we live, people were really kind of forming pods and in-person options. So we had about 10 students in our virtual program. And then we offered electives, and those classes would, you know, some of them would include other students, you know, doing other things. In terms of the classes were small. So that was a huge bonus too. The classes were really small. In terms of, like, creating a social community, we have age groups with the classes, but then we do these, like, intermixed events, social events and celebrations and stuff like that, poetry readings. And we're going to do an Earth Day festival and, you know, those kind of things to create that kind of social environment too, which is really nice. So socially, that was how we created community. Okay. Virtually was, like, mixing the ages and stuff.
Wow. So in terms of, I mean, you mentioned that this was a particularly kind of economically driven and kind of an American problem or issue, or, you know, with the way that education is, you know, its place. What other systems do you think would have to change or be revolutionized for this kind of really new, you know, revolutionary educational system to really, you know, get entrenched, to take off, if they don't.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's so so many, right? Like, it would be a total social but I think that's what's happening. I mean, I think we're at a time in history right now where we're at a turning point, and there have been these times in history where society is ready to revolutionize and really change things. And it's technology driven, which I'm not personally, I don't get excited about technology.
Yeah.
but I also recognize it as the reality, the driving factor. You know, it's not something that it's just is. It's where we're at. So I do think that technology changes a lot. And so when you ask the question of how it can change, I think a lot of it's actually already happening. So after the pandemic, you know, a huge percentage of the workforce has realized they can do their jobs at home via technology. So that piece is in place. So parents can be working and also be at home watching their kids. So that piece is there.
Yeah.
There, I think also it's interesting because there's in Hudson, there's this pilot program called Hudson Up, which is a universal income program that they're piloting. And I know that it's, you know, what people think is of as a radical idea, but it is gaining a little bit of traction in this country, the idea of universal basic income. So that would change things, because if you had universal basic income, then parents could be more engaged in the upbringing of their children and on a daily basis. And honestly, I'll be honest with you, part of starting the school with Libri was when my first child was very young, and I was imagining, I was working full time in an office job, and I went back to work after my maternity leave. And I was, you know, lamenting the missed time with my baby. My husband, who is an artist and has a studio at home, was able to be with her. So I was happy to know that she was with one of us, that she was being raised by her parents. And while I was at work, she was with her dad, but I still missed that time. And then I thought to myself, well, when she's not a baby anymore, you know, I'll have more time with her. And then I realized, I thought, well, I guess I didn't think I'd have more time with her, but I guess I thought I won't be, quote unquote, missing so much of that time, because she'll be at school anyways when I'm at work. So, you know, it's kind of like I wasn't thinking of her sitting at work thinking, well, she's at home and I'm like here sitting at my desk, right? So I thought, you know, I'll be sitting at my desk thinking she's at school anyway, so I couldn't be hanging out with her.
Right. Might as well be at work.
Yeah, yes. Exactly. Might as well be at work. But then it dawned on me that I was like, no, wait a minute. That's not going to work out, because we'll be two ships in the night, because she'll be coming home from school. I'll be still at work. Mm-hmm. I'm coming home from work. She'll be ready for dinner and bed. So I realized that the life, you know, as laid out before me was going to be one in which I was really just stealing moments with the thing that was most important to me. I mean, becoming a mother was a major, major part of my journey. And it was like one of the most important things in my life. And I thought, well, how can I solve this solution? How can I solve this problem? Well, I can start a school, and then she'll be at school and I'll be working. And, you know, so, but that's just a personal perspective, but probably shared by many, many people who weren't able to or didn't decide to start their own schools as a way to address that. They, you know, other solutions. So I think that it's a great direction for parents to be spending more time with their children. The working at home phenomenon that I think is here to stay is setting that us up for that. The idea of a universal basic income could be amazing for a lot of, especially lower income families, where, you know, it just would kind of be a baseline, and then they could be more engaged in their children's lives. Mm-hmm. And then also the way we organize community. Mm-hmm. I think like a lot, you know, there's a lot of talk, and I, you know, it's not like I've seen it manifest yet completely, but I know that the movement is sort of there for more communal living situations where people are talking about, you know, having a handful of families come together and all invest in a piece of property and build houses on the property and then share, you know, caretaking, maintenance responsibilities, childcare responsibilities. And so there's, you know, it wouldn't be great to have just like lots of communities that are disconnected from each other, but somehow if we became less isolated and individualistic in our way of living, that could be good. And then so that community support would really, I think, encourage a new way of educating children. Yeah. So it'd be the work, the community piece, like, you know, and that would impact even the way we set up our towns and cities and transportation systems so that we could live in a way that was freer for children to move around safely. Because right now, I mean, where I live, and I think in most places in America, you don't really feel safe anymore letting your children be moving independently from places. So if they have to go, you know, from their friend's house to soccer practice, or from school to soccer practice, or if, you know, they have to be supervised or accompanied by a parent or an adult, as opposed to, even though they're capable of going from that place, one place to another, you don't, the way we set up our communities and societies, you don't feel safe. And I think that needs to change. And I'm hoping that'll change. I think that's sadly, I'm not seeing a lot of movement in that direction yet. But that would be amazing if that could happen. And I think about other countries where children can, it's just sort of a social expectation that children move around freely within that society. And then there's also social expectation that adults, whether they're parents or not, are looking after the well-being of children. And there's like sort of the neighborhood watch that's embedded in a cultural understanding, as opposed to the idea of neighborhood watch. Okay. And then the other thing is, I think of this educational movement out of Italy called Reggio Emilia, from the Reggio Emilia region of Italy. And I don't know if you are familiar with that movement.
A little bit. It's sort of, and I think you mentioned it as well. It's kind of you're educating the child in front of you.
Yes. So the history of that is that it was a small region in a small rural region in northern Italy that there were just sort of a group of really sort of visionary educators that started to rethink the way early childhood education was being done, mm-hmm. and understood that it could really be improved and changed. And so they just started working in a very local way in changing the way early childhood education looked. And it was in the public school system of that region. And it just kind of over time became this entire movement that's affected education internationally. And there's so many philosophies and ideas in that kind of were born out of that movement that are so poignant. And one of the things, like I said, educating the child in front of you, another thing that I thought was amazing was that they were saying that, you know, in the town that this educational movement started, they were saying that children are part of the fabric of society. There is no space or place within that town that you wouldn't expect not to see a child. So there's no bar, there's no restaurant, there's no space that children are not allowed, or children, you know, you just, they just operate in a way where you expect children to be everywhere. And mm-hmm. and that really struck me, because I believe that we're in America, it's just the opposite. You kind of have to be, you expect children to be nowhere. The children are completely unseen, segregated from the daily, you know, movements of our lives and society. And you actually have to specify, you know, child friendly, or like, and you know, if you're going to, it's sort of like this, you know, this totally different way of seeing children. And I think that that would be amazing if that could change. Because then what happens is education really becomes like a living, breathing part of everyone's existence. And children are naturally brought into a way of being that's very organic and holistic, in the sense that they understand what it means to be a member of the community and the society, and they start learning all different kinds of professions, because they're interacting with the post person, they're interacting with, you know, the carpenter, they're interacting with the police officers, because that's how adults relate to children. And you know, they're always teaching, so teaching becomes part of life, right? All the adults are always caregiving, or they're always teaching. And then again, that responsibility gets shared, kind of circles back to our conversation about schools. Like, why have we dumped this massive, very incremental responsibility of raising children onto an institution like a school?
Right.
And also even the architecture, I mean, I go on and on, but I also think about the architectures of schools. And I think that that speaks volumes to the way we relate to education and children. It's like, why do our public schools look like prisons? I mean, why are these factories? Yes. These massive buildings, impenetrable. You hardly ever see children around them. You drive by them and the children are all inside locked up, you know, and people are not allowed in and out. That's another thing about starting Libru was very adamant that it should be operate like I called a contemporary one-room schoolhouse, operate like a one-room schoolhouse of the past, where it's really kind of just a community building and the classroom is transparent. Like you open the door and there's the classroom and that's where all the kids are and that's where all the teachers are and they're all sharing space. And as a parent, when you drop off your child, you see that and you walk in and you are immediately part of the classroom community. Whereas the way traditional schools are set up, it's just a drop, you know, you don't even, a lot of times parents aren't even allowed into the school building. Yeah. And your child gets swallowed up by this massive building down a corridor. Yes.
I would, a couple of times I'd say, well, I'm going to go, you know, into the classroom and say, oh, well, have you arranged it with the teacher? And so, you know, and thinking, why is this happening? I mean, yeah, exactly. That is, it just felt so counterintuitive to, you know, what. And I think, I mean, don't you think that, and here's what's interesting is that kids, they are always learning, no matter what we try and how we try and compartmentalize it or where we want to put them to no, you're going to learn over here and you're not, you know, I mean, they are always learning. And so why, you know, yeah, why does this, our culture, this, I would just say it was as American, you know, why do we think that they're not always learning? And, you know, why do we, like you said, just compartmentalize it? And it just seems so, again, I'm just excited to hear you talk.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know, again, like I'm totally open and, you know, I don't have the answer to, I haven't like settled on a model that I think will work. And I think maybe the other thing is that going away from this idea that it has to be one model, like it, I feel like maybe it's different people and pieces coming together to create kind of, you know, an educational experience. Now it's that creates more responsibility for the parent because they're going to have to decide, you know, do I want to enroll in this program or that program? But that, you know, that could really be a beautiful way for children to be educated in the world. Like for me, I think like, okay, I could do 3 hours of academic learning a morning if I think of my own kids, just my own. I could do 3 hours of academic, rigorous academic, really highly focused academic learning in the morning. And whether that's in person or virtual, or whether I'm teaching or another person's teaching, or whether they're self-learning, you know, whether it's academic texts that they actually, you know, figure out how to get their own resources and teach themselves what they need to know, whatever that looks like. I do believe that children, we owe it to children to give them that focused academic learning. I'm not a believer in sort of just free school or just forest programs and, you know, or unschooling. I think unschooling is interesting, but I think that you need to stay on top of it in the sense that that you just, I think, you know, we owe it to our children to give them those skills, those academic skills, those thinking skills, so that they have the tools to further, you know, further their minds and their agency in the world. Yeah. And then I was thinking, then it's kind of like, I don't think that their whole day should be in a classroom, you know, focused on that. I think that they should be living the way humans live. They should be out in the garden. They should be farming. They should be in the forest. They should be, I'm saying that because I live in a rural environment, but in the cities, they should be interning. They should be helping with childcare in a positive way, you know, not as a burden, but like, you know, like designing fun games for children of younger ages and working together in groups to start businesses or make things, do handwork. There's just endless code. They could start designing their own video games. There's just endless possibilities and they're so creative. They're so smart. I just see that as a super positive way of being you know, in the world for them. And also in terms of social justice, I mean, there is no one in the world who has a deeper sense of justice and compassion and right and wrong as children, younger children. And if we listened a little harder to the kind of things, you know, the world that they want to live in, I think that we'd all be happier. And I think that that voice is super important. And that if they, I mean, Greta Thunberg is a great example of somebody who went on school strike and look what she's done. You know, she could have been sitting in a classroom, but instead, you know, the change that she's created in the world and the moral compass she, you know, she is for so many people. And just, so I think children need to be more, at the end of the day, what I think is that it's time to start respecting children more and not saying you're, you know, wait to grow up, but just be and do now. And then acknowledge and then understand. And I think that this, that the important part is as adults really know our place. What do they need us to provide for them? We need to provide structure. We need to provide guidance. We need to provide strong boundaries. We need to provide safety. We have to create those safe spaces. You know, we have to provide the resources and tools so that, you know, so that they can learn. And we have to, and there are some very important skills that we need to teach directly. And then, yeah, but that's not, the way schools are set up, that is not happening. And it's definitely time for a change. And it would be really nice to see, I mean, it'd be really nice to see some like big, big change. Public schools are so like kind of they're the backbone of universal education, and yet they're so impenetrable on so many levels in terms of change. And so that's interesting. But I think that they will. I think that what I kind of see is like the more parents pulling kids out of public schools to homeschool, that's going to send a message to public schools that they need to ask those parents why, and then start changing their programming so that.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question, is the where would public schools fit in this future? I wonder, you know, like so many other public institutions, in the way that things had been going, particularly before the election, with the privatization of everything, you know, I wonder, you know, will they just completely collapse and then something brand new will come up?
The service provider needs to be set up first. Take care of that now.
I don't know what that is. I'm so sorry. I don't know what happened. You started talking to me. My apologies.
Okay. Here's what I found online.
I don't know what's happening. One moment.
Okay.
I'm going to turn that off. Speaking of creepy technology.
I know, yeah.
My son usually hangs out down here, so I have no idea what just started speaking to me. But yeah, so with public education, I wonder, and like you said, it is so impenetrable, and it does seem so, you know, slow to change, to get inside and, you know, even make the smallest sort of, except on these little, you know, there seem to be these little local pockets that, you know, are able to somehow, you know, get in there and do some really, you know, progressive programming within the public schools, little by little. So I wonder if you envision going inside the public schools, I mean, or the educators that you speak with, are the conversations about how can we get in and change the public schools to reach, you know, for more equity, for, you know, or is it more burn it all down and start somewhere else?
Well, when I speak to other educators about that, generally they, you know, kind of respond with like this, like defeatist, deflated. I've tried this way and that way, and it's just, I've given up. This is the feeling. Now, I haven't, as an educator personally, because I started Libre School outside of the public school system, I haven't had that experience of burnout and total disillusionment, right? So where I'm at in my journey now is actually more, so I think like a lot of those educators are kind of feeling like so burnt out because they feel so defeated because they've tried and it's just frustrating, that they're kind of like, no, we're creating alternatives, which I think that ultimately that's what it's about. And that's where I'm going to end up anyways. And that's what I did with Libre was you don't change the predominant model. You create alternatives that then flourish and thrive and then, you know, get repeated and reiterated. And then they change, you know, the mainstream model.
Yeah.
It becomes outdated. Okay. So I think that that's probably what's going to happen with public school. Now, the idea of public education, I think, is so important to safeguard. I think that that a lot of public schools are more kind of holding on to systems that are outdated and serving the wrong purpose now, but for a lot of reasons. And I think that's just sort of the bureaucracy and the layers of bureaucracy that you need to get through in order to create any kind of substantial change. But it's a situation like the pandemic that actually I think has the potential to instigate major rethinking and restructuring and change. So right now that's a big question for me, is how to reach public school systems and students and teachers. And that's my question. Cause that's actually what I'm really most interested in. And so I'm having conversations with people and it's interesting. I just had a conversation with two people in Hudson who are not educators, mm-hmm. But they are really interesting and they are going to start a gap year program. They're going to start this like academy that's to address sort of the year after high school. Mm-hmm. For low income people, for people of color who might not be ready to go to college or might not ever end up going to college, but they could really have a educational experience that, you know, broadens their horizons. But they kind of smiled when I was talking to them about my ideas, and they're like, "We can help you get in." You know, I think that there's ways that we can find to get in and start influencing and penetrating that kind of public school system and then seeing where that goes. I guess what I was thinking was that, you know, a lot of public school systems will have these grant programs or residency programs and you can come in, or after school programs. And I think you can enter that way, but I'd love to see it. You know, the thing for me is that I don't like the icing on the cake. Like it's the bread and butter that needs to change, right? So how do you influence that? I think it's just continuing to have conversations. There's a lot of institutions and people working in that regard. So I think there's a lot going on. It's just like, when is the system going to give? And I do think that as we come out of this pandemic, the public school system is going to realize that they failed. You know, this pressure was really, except for individual cases, was too much for the parents, kids, and the teachers. And they're going to be hearing it from all three sides, or seeing it, observing it. And it's going to force them to rethink things. And then that's, I think, when all of these systems that, you know, they have been holding on to will be just, they won't be able to justify anymore. Like how, you know, they're going to just have to be able to say, this hasn't worked, we did fail, so what next? And then it's in that what next moment that they'll be open to voice. Now, who rises to the top and really influences is a different question, because the reason why public schools are the way they are now is because Horace Mann rose, you know, back in the 1800s, there's this common school. So there will be a voice, and it won't necessarily be the most progressive, you know, who knows what voice will rise.
Right. Who's going to fill that vacuum?
Yeah, but yes. there will be a vacuum, and it is interesting. And I do think that the movement of really rejecting this kind of industrial model of education, it has been going strong for many years now. And so I think that that's kind of, I think that we're going to be heading in that direction. So I'd love to see public schools still exist, but I mean, like, I'd love to see them exist in a different way. Like people rethinking the way they're physically structured, the way great, like I think they should be multi-age environments. I think that they should be open, you know, a lot more, like there's a great architect who's working in this field who is pushing just the idea of like architectural design and how we should just really rethink the way we set up classrooms. So we shouldn't have long corridors with this like separate rooms. Like let's, you know, there are pullout rooms for different specific purposes, but then there should be a lot more open common spaces. And if you're building a new private school, that's what, you know, what school designers are doing already. So yeah. And I think, I'm sure there's tons of public schools in America who are already doing this. It's just sort of like getting to the, so making it the norm, I guess. And
right. Yeah. That saturation point where it's,
yeah, making it the baseline expectation. I think we're pretty close. I think we're pretty close because I think, I mean, yeah, very few parents I talk to, you know, say like, yeah, I want my kids sitting in rows and taking tests all day. You know, most parents are past that point. So I think we're really close. And I think that, you know, I think that we can see public schools really change, not to remove the public school system, but to just change the norm, change what it looks like. And wouldn't it be great too if kids weren't in those buildings all day long? That kids, as part of the public school education, they are in the community. They are, mm-hmm. you know, out of those buildings as part of their school day.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that'd be amazing.
Yes, it would. You know, I read this and I was trying to find it and I couldn't find it again. It was a very quick article about this anthropologist who had studied child rearing practices all over the world. And she had done it when her child was a baby. So she was like two. So she took her toddler all over and was studying all these child rearing practices and said, you know, it was the best thing that ever happened to her in terms of her, you know, approach to her own parenting, because she realized that in the United States, how much we sort of, again, and it goes back to this compartmentalized, like, okay, I have my kid and I have to entertain my kid. And it's not this like fluid part of, you know, waking up and we're going to clean the house today and we're going to do this. And they just sort of come along with your routine, but it's like it's kind of gotten to this point where it's like, oh, okay, what are we going to do? Like you said, that's kid friendly. We have to go to a children's museum and we have to do, you know, we have to create and kind of, and it's exhausting and, you know, it just kind of puts this other pressure on parenting in this country where, you know, you feel like it's this other whole job when really she's like all around the world, it's like, you know, children are just underfoot and they just watching you, what you're doing. That's how they're learning. And they watch how to be part of the community and they watch, you know, they're just there. It's not this whole big thing where you have to stop everything. And now you live a child friendly life, you know, it was very interesting. And I was hoping to find that, but it really made me rethink a lot of the ways that I approach, you know, thinking about how do I, you know, stimulate my son and get him get him thinking and, you know, or is it just, I'm kind of doing what interests me. And then he watches and learns how to find things that interest him by watching, you know, modeling this instead of feeling like you've got to stop and focus on them and that it sort of creates this weird impression to them that they're like the center of the universe, right?
And absolutely.
It kind of just upends everything. And yeah, so she said, I was so happy that I had this project when my child was two, because we just lived this really wonderful, you know, chilled out life, and we're really happy anyway. So
And also with children, you know, this world, and I think, so this is a huge benefit. And even the most type A personalities that I've spoken to who were parents who, you know, their children were enrolled in this after school activity. And, you know, they're between the husband and the wife, their schedules were so tightly booked between work, social engagements, and their kids, like after school activities, even them after this year, the pandemic, they feel silly. Like, you know, I've spoken to parents who are of that mindset and they're like, what were we thinking? We will never go back to that. You know, that was ridiculous. Who was it benefiting? Like, they were just realized, like, we were miserable. Our kids could do with less, you know, and like, and a lot of the activities were kind of imposed on the kids. So I completely agree with that. And as an educator, we, you know, we see in the classroom that when you are relating to your child like that, then the child has way less agency. And, you know, the child then doesn't know what to do with themselves when they're left to their own devices. So without like an adult led structured activity, you know, this is what you're going to be doing, do this, I'm going to put everything in front of you and, you know, do that. And then the child just is like, you know, stunned and bored and frustrated and doesn't know what to do with themselves. And that is not, you know, that is not what you want to see. And so, you know, it's funny because at a school like Libri, when you see that, you want as an educator, which is very ironic, to just hold more space of unstructured.
Yeah. Be bored.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Which is like, you know, you don't, it's ironic, but you don't want to drop your child off at school. So the educators
learn how to be bored. Yes. Right.
But because, you know, as educators, we're always just watching children and trying to assess what they need to, you know, develop in a healthy way.
Right.
That was often a big need, was this.
Sure.
It's like interact with other kids without parental supervision, you know, make mistakes, then learn how to make good after you've made that mistake, and all of those things. Also, even spatial awareness and navigation is that within this world of screens where parents are always hooked in, and now kids are always hooked in and to their phones, children are losing the sense of how to negotiate physical space with each other. Again, another reason why in person is so important too is just you know, people and children will just literally walk into each other without they're not taking stock of the others around them and then navigating, negotiating their space. And part of it is the screen, but again, part of it is the cultural aspect of really when you're raising children, like you said, with this bizarre perception that they're the center of the world and nothing else exists except to sort of cater to their
entertain.
Yeah, then they're not, you know, aware in a multi-sensory way of their time and place and what's going on around them, because they're not asked to. Whereas in other cultures where they are just kind of carried along with normal life, well, you might be in the middle of a field and there's a water buffalo coming that way, and you have to be constant, you know, as you're there, you have to be aware of your surroundings at all times. And I think that's really important. And I think that's how American culture used to be.
Mm-hmm.
And you see, you know, it's even with like family businesses and generational businesses and craftsmanship and all that stuff, you know, you see the kids who are, you know, with hammer in hand at 6 years old, 7 years old with the father, the grandfather, whatever, you know, that kind of thing, or just helping around the house. All of those things used to be part of, I think, just the way we raised kids too in this country. And it's the times. And I don't think it's just American. I do think it is kind of driven by this now global economy, you know, it is an economic thing, not, but since American economy kind of drives the world economy, we can call it American, but I think
it's this American sensibility that's definitely not just in America, but
exactly. Sure it feels. So hopefully, I mean, I am hopeful that we are going to enter a time of change on all of these levels. And I think we will. I think that the pandemic has gone on so long that everyone, no matter what station in life they are, has had to grapple with some pretty deep personal questions, and where we end up will be different when we all are, you know, reforming and thinking about new ways to gather. And I guess that's in terms of school, that's sort of an exciting time for me, because I think we're slowly emerging again, and we're slowly finding new ways of being together.
Right.
So if we do that mindfully, it could be a really exciting time to find ways of being together that are more connected and meaningful. Hopefully.
Hopefully. Yes. Yes. Wow. Well, you know, I very quickly, one last question, and then I know we've gone over our time, but I'm just really quickly curious about how you see the vaccine, how that has played into maybe thinking more about in-person stuff, or has it or hasn't it, or sort of how do you view the vaccine as a, is it hopeful, or is it?
I've definitely seen the vaccine rollout as a hopeful indicator of families being more open to and having their kids come back into person situations. I do think it's still, I've never seen the vaccine as like, a cure-all. We still have to be very careful. It's, mm-hmm. you know, it's patchy. And then with new variants, some of the news currently makes me think that we can't be too optimistic about the timeline of like what, you know, it definitely seems like it's still going to be a long road ahead of starts and stops, much like it has been this past year. But I think that with the vaccine, there's more of an opportunity to reemerge. I guess I see it as like a slow reemergence. I feel like it's like the beginning of a long journey of bringing kids back together again. I definitely don't see it as like the vaccine is going to like allow us to open schools and boom, we're good, you know, but you know, the past year has also shown that, with mitigating measures in place, you can control spread in schools. It's not foolproof though. And I mean, there's some really troubling news, I have to say. About a month ago, I was pretty optimistic about the impact the vaccine would have. And I still am tentatively optimistic, but I also am seeing some really troubling news about new variants. And also kind of the longer we're in this pandemic, it actually seems like there's, you know, it's the virus is actually starting to affect younger and younger people as well. And, you know, and like what's happening in Brazil right now, suddenly they're seeing a huge spike in cases in children and babies. And so it's just like, it seems to be, you know, it's almost like we need these windows of hope to kind of
function.
Yeah. But we have to also realize that, you know, it's not, you know, it's definitely going to be an ongoing process. Mm-hmm. And but, you know, the again, the silver lining of that is that there, it, the virus is demanding that there is no back to normal, which is what I was hoping. Like, I was like, with all the loss and for everything we've lost and gone through, to me, the light at the end of the tunnel is opportunity for positive change, right? And at the beginning of the pandemic, when, you know, people were kind of operating with like, this will be 6 months and then done. We just have to get through this 1 year and then done. And then, you know, I was imagining this situation where people would just try and snap back to what the world looked like before. And then there was all loss and and no change. I think that, you know, the virus is showing us that, you know, that's not the way forward. We have to change the way our behavior, we have to change the way we move through this world. And that's a good thing. And we haven't talked about climate change, but climate change is huge. Like, you know, just taking that on. And I think, yeah, just there's so much around that question. And children are so much more deeply invested in that issue than adults are, even though we want to be. I mean, they experience it as like, it's like their world, their future, they're inheriting this. And so I think that there's also a lot to be said in terms of, you know, like, that's a pressing issue for the youth of today. So let them work on that. Let them think on that. Let them act on that, and don't stick them in classrooms and tell them, you know, tell them to learn about like this that isn't that relevant to their lives. So again, there's just so many pressing issues, and the virus itself is forcing humanity to change the way we behave. And even though it's troubling and it can be really difficult to think, oh, the vaccine's not going to be foolproof, and like, we'll still be very tentative about having children gather, but it'll give us enough of a baseline protection that we can take, you know, the risk, you know, we can take some risk and have children gather, et cetera, et cetera. It'll just be a process, but that process, I think, will create more space for change to really have time for people to start developing new ideas, for people to start trying new things. And because we're just not snapping back to normal, like, for example, what we do in our free time too, again, it's not going to just snap back to the way it was. So all of that, I think it is an opportunity for us to really kind of go deeper and really kind of make some deep change. And also give us time to normalize. I mean, how great is it that we'll have more than a year to normalize this thing of being with family all the time? You mean, like, it's you can either look at it as like one great year, mm-hmm. you know, where families got to be together all the time, or if the virus is not really, you know, if the virus is continuing to force us to, you know, actually spend more time at home, then maybe it's not just one great year. Maybe it's like, oh, that completely changed the way we live as families. Now we're totally dependent on each other. And mm-hmm. yeah, so even though the vaccine is making it seem like, okay, we're going to have a baseline level of protection for teachers and children and parents, so it'll feel safer for children to be able to gather, it's not going to be like overnight, you know. Open it up overnight. And I think that it's a mistake to try and kind of think of it that way.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that we have some intelligent leaders right now in government who are able to think more complex ways about these issues. So I'm hoping that the rhetoric from above kind of reflects that nuance.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yes,
it is nice to hear some nuanced rhetoric coming from above.
Yeah, exactly. And it's because I think that's huge. I mean, that's really important. I mean, that makes a huge difference in terms of the way we move forward. So
okay. Well, Jennifer, I am so excited to see what the next iteration of your journey is going to be. And I hope that you, I mean, I can't thank you enough for talking with me today. I could just go on and on and on.
It's really exciting to talk to you.
Oh, thank you so much. So I'm going to stop the recording, but I will still be here if you have any questions. So thank you. And you know, I did want to say, I don't think I said the date in the beginning, but it is April 16th, 2021. And appreciate you so much. Thanks.
Thank you.